Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Michelle Pascucci. I'm a partner at Donnelly, Conroy & Gelhar. And I'm really excited to announce this fantastic panel that we have slated for today on loss, restitution, and forfeiture in white-collar cases. We're likely going to run a little over an hour, and we hope you can stay for the full time because we have some awesome content. As all of you know, when you're representing a white-collar defendant facing sentencing, the most significant factor in any guidelines calculation is going to be loss. And sometimes calculating loss can be really straightforward, but I think as all of us know, it can also be really complicated. And loss has the potential to impact defendants in a really huge way, more than any other single factor at sentencing. It can determine a sentence of incarceration, and it can also impact the monetary penalties that your client can face for a really long time. So today we're lucky to have a team of fantastic current and former federal prosecutors who are going to walk through these issues. They need no introduction, yet I will give each of them a brief introduction. We have Carol Head, who's a current assistant United States attorney in the District of Massachusetts and chief of the Asset Recovery Unit. We have Kate Human, Hammond, my apologies, who's head of government investigations at Pierce Atwood and previously served as a prosecutor for the fraud section of the Department of Justice. We have David Lazarus, who's a partner at Verrill Dana and former assistant United States attorney with the District of Massachusetts, also former head, former chief of the Asset Recovery Unit. And we have Eric Christofferson, a partner at DLA Piper and also a former assistant United States attorney with the District of Massachusetts. I'm going to briefly outline the next hour or so. We're going to start with Carol, who's going to walk us through some of the financial penalties that your defendants will likely face after sentencing in a white-collar case. That's restitution, forfeiture, and fines. We're going to turn to Kate, who's going to walk us through an introduction of 2B1.1. That's a section of the sentencing guidelines governing loss and the methods of calculating loss. And then David is going to walk us through a recent proposed amendment of the sentencing proposed by the Sentencing Commission regarding the recent Third Circuit case, United States v. Banks, had a huge impact on intended loss. And then from there, we're going to open it to some Q&A because I know that all of you are going to have some great questions and we have some questions prepared too. And a word to the wise, if you just enter questions in your Q&A, I'll make sure to get them to the presenters, as many of them as I can. So with that being said, I'm going to turn the proverbial microphone over to Carol to get started. And thank you all for being here.
Great. Thank you so much, Michelle. So as Michelle said, I'm the chief of the Asset Recovery Unit at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And generally, when you're thinking about your defendant's sentence in a typical white collar case, that's going to concern three areas: the loss for purposes of sentencing guidelines. And here, we're going to have a conversation about that, but the USAO looks at intended loss. Restitution, which is the victim loss amount, how much the victim's loss is part of the crime, and forfeiture, which is not really a loss number, but it's the proceeds that the defendant obtained as a result of the crime. And sometimes there's also a fine component, but I'm going to focus on restitution and forfeiture. So as chief of the Asset Recovery Unit, I'm focused on the restitution and forfeiture aspects of a criminal sentence. Our unit has, including myself, five AUSAs. We have numerous support staff. We have two investigators. In fiscal year 2023, we recovered over $42 million in restitution and fines and over $22 million in criminal and civil forfeiture. So we're very active in this space. Our mandate is to recover for victims, recover funds for victims, to seize and forfeit criminal proceeds, to disrupt criminal enterprises, and to take the profit out of criminal activity. So we get involved in the case in a number of number of ways. So early in the criminal case, we work with the criminal AUSA to identify potential assets for seizure and restraint. And we review indictments to make sure that the appropriate forfeiture language is included in there. At the plea and sentencing phases, we make sure that assets, restitution, forfeiture are all accounted for in the plea agreement and that the proper motions are filed and the proper restitution is imposed at sentencing. We can also, in the plea phase, work with defense counsel on early payment of restitution and forfeiture, and potentially even structuring payment plans. And then post-sentencing, we work to collect, right? So we become the collection arm. And so we collect the restitution, the fines. Probation often takes the lead on the restitution, at least in terms of a payment plan during supervised release, but then we take over in full, and also forfeiture money judgments. And we, and this collection phase may include litigation about the forfeiture of assets and third party interest. It may include litigation about, you know, other aspects of garnishment or executing on property. And we handle all that. So back in, restitution and forfeiture are both mandatory parts of sentencing in most white collar cases. It is not considered double recovery because they serve different purposes. Restitution is to make the victim whole for their losses, and forfeiture is to deprive a criminal defendant of the proceeds of their criminal activity. Both are statutory creations, and that's very important because what we can and cannot do is governed by statute. As parts of the sentencing phase, they are both determined under a preponderance of evidence standard, and the court can base the determination of forfeiture and restitution like sentencing, other sentencing issues based on information that it deems reliable. So turning to restitution, under the Crime Victim Rights Act, victims have the right to full and timely restitution as provided by law. And we know that the Department of Justice has taken many steps to make sure that victims are elevated and receive their rights under throughout the criminal prosecution. And restitution is a very important part of that. So in most white collar cases, the applicable statute is going to be the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act. And it, as it says in its title, it's mandatory. In most white collar cases, the amount of restitution is going to be equal to the victim's pecuniary loss. Although, and that also can include other things such as a victim's attorney's fees as a result of participation in the investigation or prosecution and other necessary expenses as spelled out in the statute, which may include like transportation costs and lost income. The victims for restitution purposes need to be identifiable and they need to have an identifiable loss amount, but the victim doesn't actually need to come forward. We have some cases where we're able to discern the name and loss amount of the victim where they may not have even contacted us, and we're obligated to seek restitution for them. It also applies, a victim is anyone who was harmed in the course of the scheme or conspiracy, and that's specifically spelled out in the Mandatory Victims Rights Act. So Restitution Act, I'm sorry. So if your defendant is charged with a scheme or a conspiracy, the potential victim pool is the victims of that scheme or conspiracy, regardless of, you know, whether there's one element of wire fraud charged. The defendant's ability to pay is not a factor in determining restitution. A victim is not entitled to recover more than their loss, but importantly, it does not matter if the victim was compensated by insurance because the the restitution statute accounts for that. And to the extent that there was insurance paid, the insurer can step in as the victim there. So it may be that the victim gets the deductible and they'll be paid first, and then anything recovered after that would go to the insurance company. But if the victim goes and does self-help or has recovered other assets, those should be credited against a victim's against the restitution amount and the defendant's loss amount. Restitution can be joint and several with other defendants. So you have, if you have a conspiracy and other co-defendants, restitution is typically ordered in a joint and several manner. The statute does allow that you can apportion restitution amounts among defendants. So it may be joint and several up to a certain amount, but one defendant is more culpable and may be responsible for more. And the statute says that is to reflect the level of contribution to the victim's loss and economic circumstances of each defendant. Importantly there, it's talking about apportionment among defendants. So if you have uncharged co-conspirators and you want to have your restitution reduced based on that, we are not going to support that because, as I said at the beginning, the victim is entitled to full and timely restitution. There's no other defendant to apportion that restitution amounts to. Under the MVRA, restitution lasts 20 years. So it's a judgment that we can collect for 20 years after release from prison. And if the defendant should die during that time period, in most cases, we can also pursue collection against the estate. And like I said, there's nothing about getting the restitution judgment order that would preclude a victim from seeking their own recovery independently. But, you know, if that happens, we would like to credit credit the defendant's restitution judgment. However, it's got to be for the same harm. So that's kind of we'd have to look at that carefully to make sure that whatever the victim recovered was for the same loss that the restitution was ordered. So that's a really quick overview of some of the important aspects of restitution. As I said, forfeiture is also mandatory, and it's under a different statutory scheme. And there's many forfeiture statutes, and what is forfeitable really depends on the crime charged and the forfeiture statute that's associated that crime. So wire fraud is typically, we can forfeit proceeds of the criminal activity. Insider trading, typically it's also proceeds, but in an insider trading case, there's the ability to deduct the cost of the purchase of the stock. And under case law that's interpreted that, and money laundering is broader than proceeds. It can include proceeds, facilitating property, and even commingled property that was involved in the money laundering. And RICO is even broader. It encompasses all of those forfeiture, but also adds like forfeiture of the enterprise, the property of the enterprise or the whole enterprise, right? So very broad. Those are the typical charges I think we see in white collar cases. There are other forfeiture statutes for drug cases. I didn't mention healthcare fraud actually forfeits, the forfeiture specifically spelled out is gross proceeds of a healthcare fraud offense. So it's really important to understand the statute and what it allows the forfeiture of. Forfeiture allows the United States to seize and restrain property even pre-indictment, right? So it's oftentimes we can get involved in the case very early on in the investigation, very early on, and we can execute seizure warrants and restraining orders simultaneously or even maybe before the criminal indictment happens or the criminal complaint happens. And that the property that we can restrain and seize must be traceable to the offense conduct. We can also get a money judgment at sentencing, but that is if the property that was purchased with the proceeds is no longer available, and those tend to last until the death of the defendant. So the test for forfeiture is really a but-for test, but for the crime, would the defendant have this property? And then the property at issue, the test is control. So if the defendant received property and then passed it off to his unindicted co-conspirators, he or she is potentially still responsible for that property because they controlled it and decided where it would go. Forfeiture of a money judgment is usually not joint and several, although there are certain specific instances. We tend to apportion a forfeiture money judgment if there's a conspiracy case where multiple people are charged. And that's a little high level wrap up of forfeiture and restitution. I can say that the office, as I noted, we are in charge of the collection. Generally, we prioritize collection for restitution because it's victims. And as I said, victims are entitled to full and timely restitution. The unit does a comprehensive review of defendants and we put them on payment plans. We go after assets. So we stick around for a while. So I apologize if I went over a little bit, but Kate, I'm happy to hand it over to you. You're muted, Kate.
You'd think I would have figured that out by now. But thank you very much, Carol. It's really, really useful and helpful. I also would just note really quickly, I think Michelle forgot to introduce herself. And so I will at least note that she's, like me, an alumni of the fraud section. So we're the DC refugees on the panel.
Thank you very much, Kate. I appreciate that. And, you know, it should suffice to be said, you mean the best section of the Department of Justice, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of
okay. Course. Okay.
Although, you know, they're the dark side now.
Oh, yeah.
Not Carol. Carol's fantastic. But and Michelle's also now in private practice as a partner. But I'm going to dive into the really, really exciting part of all of this, which is all the various ways that you can calculate loss under the U.S. sentencing guidelines, which is 2B1.1, which is the loss table. As Michelle noted, the loss table is one of the single most important aspects, if not the most important aspect, of calculating the sentencing guidelines, both for individuals and for companies, when you're talking about a financial crime. The differences in the loss calculation can, you know, of course, significantly alter periods of incarceration, but also can be particularly impactful on companies when that calculation ultimately goes through the multiplier effect under the culpability score in Chapter 8 of the sentencing guidelines. And I know all of you have your guidelines in front of you so that you can follow along. So the way that 2B1.1 approaches the issue of loss as an enhancement to the severity of the crime and therefore increasing the sentencing is, in order of preference, first, the loss calculation should be actual loss, if actual loss can be determined. The second calculation, and I know Dave's going to talk about this a bit because it's a little more controversial now, is intended loss, how much the defendant intended to gain or intended to harm their victim in the course of the offense. And then if actual loss and intended loss are unavailable, then the proper calculation to use is gain, which was a favorite of my old unit, the FCPA unit. Almost all of their loss calculations went off gain. Under intended loss, it's notable that, so the Sentencing Commission has issued a 28-page guide that was most recently updated in 2022. That is the primer on loss calculation. In essence, it is a bench book for judges on how to apply 2B1.1. And I think the complications involved in 2B1.1 are evident in the fact, first of all, that there is a bench book on it, and second, that the bench book is almost 30 pages long, shows that this is not a straightforward process. And the circuits certainly are not in agreement on the applicability of all the various elements of the sentencing guidelines. And I know Dave's probably going to talk about that a little bit too. But intended loss in the most recent version of the bench book, they tried to circumscribe a little and pointed at intended loss being a little bit more targeted for credit card theft, fraudulent checks, government benefits, insurance, and sort of real property fraud, real estate or mortgage fraud. So that cabining of what intended loss is designed for is a little narrower in this version of the bench book than it's been in prior versions of the bench book. The primary methods laid out in the bench book for calculating loss, and it's worth noting that the court, in determining the loss amount, can make a reasonable estimate. It does not have to be, you know, proven down to the penny. But the loss estimate cannot be arbitrary. The burden of establishing the loss initially is on the government. It can shift to the defense in certain circumstances, but at least as an initial matter, the burden is on the government. The preferred method of estimating loss is fair market value. So you look at the property that was stolen, copied, destroyed, and the loss is the fair market value of whatever that property is. Or it can also be the cost to the victim of replacement of that property. But it can also be higher than replacement value, depending on the circumstances. The operative date for fair market value is the date that the fraud ceased. So that's the most basic one and the one that's used the most often. Then there's some more special circumstance rules. One is development costs, which is a loss rule specifically designed for trade secrets where fair market value is too difficult to calculate because it's proprietary or confidential. So in that case, the cost of developing the information or the reduction in the value of the information is considered to be the loss. This can get a little crazy when you're talking about some of the things like, you know, the cases where information was stolen about proprietary ways of making aluminum cans from the Coca-Cola company, and what the actual value of that of developing that was over the years. These sums can become astronomical when it's a proprietary product for a behemoth like Coke. The next one is cost of repairs. This comes up a lot in the construction context, and it's one that can be the subject of a lot of debate during sentencing, which is the cost to fix the damage done by the fraud, or the cost, also including the cost to improve if it's necessary in order to effect the repair. So the big First Circuit case on this is probably US v. Modern Continental Corp. This also includes cost of repairs in terms of product substitution. If given an inferior product, what is the cost of replacing the inferior product with the superior product? Cost of repair was also debated in the Prosperi case, which was the adulterated concrete case in the Big Dig, but was determined to be an unreasonable sum when calculated as cost of repair because repair was determined to be impossible in that case. So cost of repair sounds really straightforward, but what it actually costs to dispose of the incorrect product or to retrofit can either be difficult to calculate or can be astronomical, and it can be a situation where the facts swallow the rule. The next one is victims times loss. So if you can come up with an average loss per victim, then multiply that by number of victims, you can use that. If the specific loss to each victim is hard to calculate, if you use this, the average estimated average loss, you can include victims who are unidentified and victims who feel like they got the benefit of their bargain. So you can sort of expand beyond sometimes the people who are unhappy if you use that loss calculation. And then the other sort of specific circumstance one is the reduction in value of securities. I think we've all seen this one play out a couple of times in the white collar press. It can be very challenging, which is the loss in value of a traded security as opposed based on the fraud of the defendant. And it can be really difficult to pull out what is due to the behavior of the defendant versus what is due to standard market forces. There are also situations where the fraud of the defendant was insufficient to cause problems in light of other market forces. The Elon Musk Tesla stock cases and arguments around that show the challenges there. But the preferred method for calculating securities loss, according to the bench book, is what's called modified rescissory method, which is the difference between the average price during the 90 days after the fraud as compared to the average price of the security during the fraud. And then you multiply that by the number of outstanding shares. But it's important to remember some rules that then apply to change that loss amount when you start with the losses under those calculations. The first essential and most important of those is the credits against loss from value received. So for services performed or value provided before the offense was detected, that is deducted from loss. And failure to deduct that from loss can be reversible error, according to the bench book, unless the fraud was so pervasive that it is not reasonably practicable to separate them. So what does it mean before the offense was detected? That's the time it was discovered by the victim or at the time that the defendant knew or should have known that it had been detected or was about to be detected. So you can't see the FBI coming and suddenly pay it all back and then not have a loss. So this is also referred to sometimes as the sums a victim would have paid absent the fraud would need to be deducted from the loss. So, for example, in the Aggregated Industries Prosperity case, one of the challenges was that a lot of the concrete that was provided was not adulterated, and that would have been paid for absent the fraud. So that was an amount that would have had to be deducted from any loss amount based on the totality of the concrete that was provided in the course of the contract. Leading case on this one in the First Circuit, if you want to look it up, is United States v. Alphys. That goes through the reduction for value received. There's also money and property returned. Again, this is prior to detection of the crime. If the money or property is returned, it is deducted from the total loss amount. And if there is collateral that was in the possession of the victim at the time of sentencing, and they are able to gain the benefit of that collateral, that's supposed to be deducted from the loss amount. When you're talking about real estate as collateral, that gets messy across circuits. So it's not entirely clear. There's a solid discussion of the various views of the circuits in the bench book if you want to take a look. I think it's worth, you know, one of the cases that shows the impact of this deduction from loss is out of the Western District of Washington, the Bradkin case, the Navy Steel cases. The company, which did sign a deferred prosecution agreement, but primarily paid $11 million, almost $11 million in civil restitution, had an offense level of 30 based on a loss that was between $9.5 million and $25 million, which is what they agreed the loss amount was somewhere in there. And given that the Navy steel fraud, it was, you know, failure to actually test steel that was being provided to go into the hull of Navy ships, which is distressing given the risk that it posed to have insufficient strength in that steel, but it occurred over close to 30 years. So clearly there was a lot of credit back on that loss amount based on fair market value received and services provided prior to detection. So I'm short on time, so I'm going to run through the rest of these. There are also exclusions from loss, interest, finance charges, late fees, penalties, agreed upon rates of return. Those sorts of things are excluded, along with the costs to the government or the costs incurred by victims to bring the case. Notably, that's a unique rule in the United States. In the United Kingdom, for example, the cost of the investigation is considered part of the loss, and the defendant is held accountable for that and actually has to pay the investigating agencies back for the cost of their investigation. There's also a series of special rules about credit cards, Davis-Bacon Act, so wages owed versus wages paid, Ponzi schemes, unlawful misrepresentation, controlled substances. I just want to call out a couple of the special rules. The first is on government benefits, which can include contracts, because the courts are split on where to apply this rule, where benefits are pursuant to a program that awards government procurement to disadvantaged businesses. But it's not the total amount of benefits received if a portion of the benefits received are legitimate. So if the contract is received even based on fraud, but legitimate services are provided in government benefits, that should be deducted unless what you end up with is a value of zero because the fraud has pervaded the contract to the point where it is without value, which is sometimes called the zero value rule. So in the context of government procurement, loss calculation can get even more complicated than it would be in the ordinary case. And then with other unlawful misrepresentation schemes, such as you're posing as a licensed professional, you put forward a product as government approved when it wasn't, which is important in, you know, pharmaceutical counterfeiting cases and cases like that. Regulated goods that didn't have proper approval, which is what the Prosperity Court eventually did use to calculate the loss in that case, and misbranded prescription drugs. Then it's the total amount paid for the product with no reduction in loss amount for any kind of value of services, because it was posing as something properly approved by the government when it was not. So that was a fire hose. And I'm going to hand off to Dave, who's going to drill down more particularly on some of this in a much more organized fashion, I'm sure. Off to you, Dave.
No pressure now. Thanks, Kate. We'll see about organized, so we can take a poll later on. But appreciate that. Thanks, everybody, for being here today. So as all of you know, 2B1.1, the loss table and the way loss is calculated are incredibly important indicators of the guidelines and also very, very often what the actual sentence the judge is going to impose at considering all the factors of 3553A. And the table that you're all no doubt familiar with increases very sharply based on what the loss is, and most often based on what the intended loss is. So for example, I deal a lot in healthcare fraud cases, and the amount billed to Medicare can be incredibly high, even though everybody knows that you bill insurance companies for one amount, but you know you will not receive that amount from them, and you'll get a much lower amount paid. And so there are certain discrepancies there. This is a time of focus on 2B1.1. It's not the first time. Back in 2014, the ABA formed a task force and issued a really great report in November of 2014 talking about the flaws in 2B1.1. I recommend anybody in the space should go take a look at that if you haven't, or if you haven't looked at it in a while. I looked through it in preparing for today and was reminded there's really some great nuggets in there. What it all really comes down to, as I'll discuss, I think at this point, is how the conversation at sentencing and in your sentencing advocacy for whichever side gets framed. And so it's not necessarily a place for a lot of legal argument at this point, which I'll talk about, but it really is a matter of, is the court going to start at a really high number and the defendant is now going to try to force that down, or is the court going to start at a much more reasonable and appropriate number and the government is going to argue to raise it higher? And so there's nothing particularly new about that, but what happened was in 2022, there was a case in the Third Circuit, United States versus Banks, 55 F 4th 246. And as the Sentencing Commission put it, the Third Circuit held that loss is unambiguous in the context of the actual guidelines in 2B1.1, and it means actual loss. And because the commentary below the actual guideline expands the definition of loss by saying it's generally the greater of actual loss or intended loss, the Banks Court, the Third Circuit, said that they could accord no weight to the commentary, and that actual loss was the factor that should be used to determine the calculations of the guidelines under 2B1.1. So that was obviously a tremendous decision in the Third Circuit for defendants. It turned sentencing and fraud cases and in other cases on their head, because it meant that the guidelines could not go to the commentary automatically, and that any of the commentary was not necessarily dispositive anymore. So the holding was significant. And if you look at an example, say, of PPP fraud cases, which there's obviously a lot of right now we're seeing, you have a defendant who perhaps submitted 10 PPP loan applications, which is not uncommon, and they received proceeds. They were funded for three of those for whatever reason. And so they got three loans, the other seven they didn't get. The issue is, under intended loss, right? Are they going to start the conversation at sentencing accountable for the 10 that they tried to get, or for the three that they actually got and walked away with that money? And so it really can have a meaningful impact. You could get as high as 8 or more levels difference often between actual and intended loss, and that can quadruple the low end of the guidelines. And so just from a starting perspective, the numbers can be incredibly high as a result of intended loss. So the Banks case was really important, and everybody watched to see what would happen. Sadly, from a defense perspective, most of the circuit courts that have considered the issue have gone the other way. Although many of those decisions have really been on an appellate review based on plain error. And so it's not exactly a real analysis of the underlying arguments in Banks, whether, for example, the term loss is ambiguous or not. If it is ambiguous under Banks, you could potentially go to the commentary. If it's not ambiguous, which they found, then you can't. So there's a lot of sort of substantive legal analysis that the circuits have not necessarily entertained, but it's clearly been percolating. District courts have been deciding it in different directions. So in the 11th Circuit, for example, following Banks, there was a case, United States versus Dupree, and that case was not a fraud case, but it was a case where the court was considering whether to go to the commentary when determining the definition of a controlled substance offense. And in that case, Dupree, following the same analysis that the Banks court did, the 11th Circuit, for the same reasons, found you could not go to the commentary if the guidelines were not ambiguous. And so that's not exactly on point in the 11th Circuit. Their district courts, I used to be in AUSA in the Middle District of Florida, so the 11th Circuit is near and dear to me. And so there are district courts in the Northern District of Florida, the Southern District of Florida, that have interpreted Dupree to follow Banks in fraud cases, but there are cases in Georgia that go the other way. And so there's a circuit split, and there's splits within circuits and analyzing and trying to read the tea leaves. And so as a result of this, in November, the Sentencing Commission proposed an amendment. They proposed a number of them, including an amendment on dealing with acquitted conduct at sentencing, which is a really important subject. And we could have a whole other webinar on that. So I'm not going to go into it, but I don't want to minimize the importance of that topic. But one of the amendments is a proposed amendment to 2B1.1. And it's in direct response to the Banks case. And what the Sentencing Commission has proposed is to move from the commentary notes to table, create a new section, which is in the guidelines called notes to table, and it's loss, gain, and then definitions of actual loss, intended loss, pecuniary harm, and reasonably foreseeable pecuniary harm. So essentially, it's a Banks fix, is what they've proposed. Interestingly, as they do, the commission also invited comment not only on the proposed guideline, but also on whether the guideline should be revised in this amendment cycle, or whether that should be put on hold pending a more comprehensive review of 2B1.1. And so the commentary and the public comments that followed have addressed both of those questions. Now, we'll get an answer on what the commission is going to do in 13 days. On April 17th, they'll be holding their vote. For those of you who are really eager, it's at 1:30 and it's going to be broadcast live on the web. So you can watch and get the late breaking news to run to LinkedIn and share with the world. But we'll find out. And so there were a number of public comments, as you would expect. before I get to those, I just want to just point out in the First Circuit, obviously relevant to all of us, there's the case United States versus Gadsden, which is 77 F416, which is in August of 23. And that was a plain error analysis looking at the district court's use of intended loss as opposed to actual loss. And the court looked at banks, looked at the First Circuit's prior decisions talking about loss. And they said that, and I'm quoting, the First Circuit has never expressed any doubt regarding the use of intended loss to the contrary. So they signaled where likely they would come down if the question were squarely presented to them, at least that panel of the First Circuit. But so far as I know, there has not been any direct presentation of the issue that they've decided. And so the issue is live. You have the proposed amendments being considered. And so the comment period, which closed in February, I thought it might be helpful to share some of the, an overview of some of the comments that were tendered to the commission. And I'm also going to talk about a live roundtable that they had with the United States attorney and two assistant federal public defenders. And it was interesting to see what the members of the commission at the roundtable were asking about. So I'll be brief if I can. Not organized as Kate promised, sorry. But so DOJ submitted a public comment and not surprisingly supported the change. They also supported a comprehensive examination of 2B1.1 in another amendment cycle. They asked the Sentencing Commission not to wait, but to implement the bank's fix, my term, now, and to deal with the overall issue during an upcoming amendment cycle. The National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys, which is an AUSA advocacy group, they submitted a comment saying they did not have a substantive comment about the proposal, but it made sense to do the fix. The National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers submitted a comment asking the commission to delay changing 2B1.1 until there could be a comprehensive review. The association pointed to the 2014 ABA task force report, which is also sometimes called the shadow guidelines. And for a while after that report was entered, it was on vogue to argue for the use of the shadow guidelines. And there were appeals at the time, whether it was error to not use the shadow guidelines, whether it was error to use the shadow guidelines. But the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers pointed out that the shadow guidelines had some very important conclusions about the overstatement of loss in 2B1.1. And they also provide a really helpful quote in their public comment from United States versus Gupta, which is an SDNY case from 2012, 904 F sub second 349. And the quote is, "The numbers assigned by the Sentencing Commission to various sentencing factors appear to be more the product of speculation, whim, or abstract number crunching than of any rigorous methodology, thus maximizing the risk of injustice." And so they recommended the commission consider removing intended loss from the loss table and treat any disparity as something to be considered as a sentencing enhancement or under the 3553A factors. Then the Practitioners Advisory Group, which is a standing advisory group. I think Sarah Silva in Boston is a delegate from the First Circuit. It's made up of circuit representatives. They recommended against any change until a comprehensive review could be conducted. And they cited some really interesting data from fiscal year 22, which supports the strong argument that the 2B1.1 guidelines are too high based on how courts actually sentenced people around the country. The Sentencing Commission estimated there were about 750 people sentenced in fiscal 22 based on intended loss as opposed to actual loss. And so it's a real number affecting real people, and it often leads to very significant and lengthy jail terms. The commission's roundtable, it was a two-day hearing, March 6th and 7th. It's available online. The bulk of it was spent talking about treatment of acquitted conduct and also treatment of youthful offenders, two very important areas, and those received the lion's share of the discussion time. The intended loss amendments did receive some discussion time, and the panel seemed to be really interested in the 2014 ABA report and what the value of that report was. And in some of the comments and in the undertones of that discussion, it's clear in my view that even the data that was used in 2014 and that was used when promulgating 2B1.1 originally is just based on very outdated information. It's not based on actual disparities in sentencing as it's played out even over the last 3-5 years. And so hopefully there will be a comprehensive evaluation of 2B1.1, whether or not the amendment passes now. In practice, just a practical application of this in practice, it's going to largely depend on the judge and on the facts of the case. And it's really a matter of framing the issue. I represented a defendant at sentencing in the Northern District of Florida after Dupree had come out, about a week after Dupree had come out. And I was able to convince the judge to apply Dupree to 2B1.1. But as is often the case, I won the legal argument, but I lost the battle because the judge then considered intended loss when looking at the 3553A factors and made a point of making clear on the record that although the guidelines may have changed, the court's view of the conduct had not. So it's helpful, but it's not a magic bullet by any means. Just very briefly, last point on the shadow guidelines. If you take a look at those, it really is an interesting way. My monitor just shut off. I don't know if everybody can hear me, but it is an interesting way of looking at the guidelines that really breaks it into culpability, loss, and victims. But I'm going to pass it off now because my computer is shutting off.
Well, that's always fun to happen, but I you know, so far we've had some really great discussion about how you actually calculate loss and what those calculations look like, how you calculate restitution and forfeiture. And I think a big question on everyone's mind is, well, what's the practical implication when you're looking at plea versus trial? We all know that you're looking at the same 2B1.1, but we know in practice it's very different. So, Dave, do you want me to start with you or do you want me to start elsewhere, given the tech issues over there?
So I'm happy to give it a go. If I cut out, please jump to someone else.
Sure.
But I think that in terms of negotiating a resolution, facing sentencing after trial or pleading open and facing sentencing before the court, in practical application, it's really going to be a function of the facts of the case, the nature of the victims or lack of victims in the case, the AUSA, the U.S. Attorney's Office or section of main justice that you're dealing with, and also, of course, the judge, the individual session within whatever district you find yourself. So in terms of dealing with U.S. attorney's offices, you know, relevant conduct is so broad that you're faced with the choice of trying to negotiate on loss. You can do depending on the facts of a specific case, and you can take a plea to a specific substantive count with the hopes that you're going to limit intended loss or actual loss to a certain conduct. You run the risk of probation disagreeing or the court disagreeing or a supervisor in the U.S. attorney's office disagreeing. And so you can also take a plea to something. You can negotiate as much as you possibly can and leave open the argument of loss at sentencing to be handled as a contested issue at sentencing. Not all AUSAs or even units within U.S. attorney's offices are prepared to do that. If they want a plea, they want to wrap everything up. So they're not willing to leave things open. And another challenge that you face if you leave that open are the financial penalties, which are crippling. And so Carroll's unit, if you can have, you know, some certainty from Carroll's unit in a plea agreement, for example, there's often value in that. Even if the numbers are incredibly high, you know what they are and your client can make plans based on that and you can sort of work forward. If you leave open loss, it very often means you're leaving open forfeiture and restitution. And so you're going into sentencing not really sure what it's going to look like. And so that is essentially scary, right? It's very scary, but it's also, it can be very dangerous to an individual facing sentencing because the variables are so massive. You can try and argue before the judge, and I've had mixed successes. I'm sure everybody on the call has on either side of the V. And you can try and do that. I think the recent conversations calling for a renewed view of the guidelines is helpful. I think that judges are typically really paying attention to what the community at large is thinking about how to apply the guidelines when it comes to disparity. So in practice, sometimes you're okay facing a judge, but you can look on the Sentencing Commission's website if you haven't, and you can review sentencing data on a really micro level, and you can get a sense of how likely that might be. A lot of times you don't even know who your judge is going to be, and judges get reassigned. And so it's a gamble no matter how you look at it. The more interested the U.S. Attorney's Office is in a plea, I find the happier they are to negotiate charges and conduct. But even that, like I said, is no guarantee. So I'll pass it back to you, Michelle. Thanks.
No, sure.
So if I could just jump in a little. I mean, I agree with everything Dave said, but I think there are two things that are worth emphasizing. One is it really does depend on which USAO you're dealing with. And I think in particular, if you're dealing with a large USAO that does a lot of complicated economic crime cases and you're negotiating loss amount during plea, you can expect a certain amount of sophistication. And people who are familiar with the shadow guidelines and people who are familiar with the bench book and have been through some of these arguments any number of times before. But if you're dealing with some of the smaller USAOs or you're dealing with a US attorney who hasn't done a case previously where the loss calculation is complicated, you can be dealing with initial proposals from the US Attorney's Office that have no bearing to any version of loss calculation at all, and sometimes are more, even more based on a civil theory of damages than the way that loss calculation goes. And it can be just a lack of experience or understanding, but sometimes it can also be just, I don't want to take the time to have this detailed argument with you about, you know, these very detailed economic calculations off of a complex economic crime case. I think the other thing that's worth noting is if you are in front of a judge as opposed to negotiating a plea, there might be a better opportunity to for where it is a really complex calculation, for example, in a securities fraud case or in a government contracting loss case. The judges are sometimes more amenable to taking the time to hear from experts on what the calculation should be. Mm-hmm. And that can go both ways. It can go in the favor of the defense or it could go in the favor of the prosecution, because of course prosecution can put on its own experts. But it is more time consuming, but you know, if you really want to get it right and you're dealing with unreasonable numbers, either unreasonably low or unreasonably high, as Dave said, it might be worth, you know, not agreeing to that and leaving it open in the plea negotiations so that you can put expert testimony in front of the court.
No, it's a great point, Kate. And Erica.
No, go ahead, Michelle.
No, it brings up an important point, too, is when we're dealing at sentencing with loss and with numbers, particularly when you have a plea and you have a question of do we discuss loss at sentencing after a plea, a huge factor is the gestalt in front of a judge. And if you're going to be contesting loss at a plea, you have to walk a really fine line of I accept responsibility and I feel so sorry for these victims, but actually their loss wasn't that bad. And how do you make that argument? And as a defense attorney, it's a super, super hard argument to make. And you have to weigh that too in figuring how much do I want to go to bat on loss right now? But Eric, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, actually, Michelle, you were sort of channeling something that I was going to say, which is a practical reality for anybody who is counseled, especially an individual where you're dealing with very scary concepts of jail and, you know, the culpability on the front end, having the ability to talk strategically with someone about what this would look like, what a contested loss hearing would look like. And frankly, just the practical reality of the difference between walking into a sentencing where everybody's on the same page and it's nice and everybody loves everybody. I'm being facetious. Or walking in and you have a contentious loss hearing, like, you know, the prosecutors obviously don't want to do that. And it puts you in an awkward spot in terms of the overall atmospherics in front of the judge. So I think that's important. The other thing I was going to mention too is that, you know, I think Kate and Dave really expertly laid out, you know, all of the issues with calculating loss. But I think something that is pretty interesting is when you're talking about joint activity and multiple people involved. And I think we could probably spend an hour talking just about that. But when you combine the loss and intended loss concepts, especially with, you know, what may be coming from the sentencing commission, with the relevant conduct section about jointly undertaken criminal activity, and you try to figure out, well, if it's intended loss, but I also undertook this with other people, and that is a reasonable foreseeability test. How do you sort of think about what did I intend versus what did the other people intend, and what was reasonably foreseeable about what that what those people were doing? And I've had a case or two where this issue has come up. The judges have not been super sympathetic to these types of arguments, I will admit. But when you start thinking about, well, what if it was actually foreseeable to my person who might have been more on the periphery, there is some case law. There's the DeLima case in the First Circuit, which talks about, you know, if you're really a minor player, then maybe that can have an effect on the loss that gets attributed to your person. But a lot of times the government isn't really as focused on that at the beginning when they're talking to your person. And so that really can complicate plea discussions and obviously can complicate how you're advising your client. The last thing I'll just mention I think Kate made a great point about who you're dealing with in terms of which U.S. Attorney's Office. But on that, the issue, it's kind of unique to the securities area, but where you're looking at the diminution of the securities value during the time of the fraudulent conduct, this comes up a lot, not only in big cases involving big companies like Twitter, but also in a lot of these market manipulation, penny stock, pump and dump cases. And I will tell you a couple of things. Is one, I'm not sure the government is always thinking about the fact that these penny stock cases, they sometimes do have residual value, these stocks. They just kind of assume sometimes that they go to zero, but they don't. And if you actually get the trading, you can see, oh, wait a second, this wasn't all the way down to zero. And you can actually reduce the amounts quite a bit. But it's important to, you know, kind of keep in mind that, you know, the government is not always right with you at the time you're thinking about the plea or you're thinking about the liability phase. Where they're sort of so down the road on loss that you can actually have a concrete discussion with them that actually will advance the ball. So,
can I make two follow-up points on that, Michelle?
Of course.
So, you know, that's really interesting. And it makes me, you know, think about another sort of practice point. And also, you know, the idea of, do you want to go in and contest this at sentencing at an otherwise friendly, so to speak, sentencing? There's sometimes value in segregating the restitution and money judgment on the forfeiture side aspects from a sentencing hearing. So maybe you're going to go in and you're not going to contest loss, but you are going to want to ask for apportionment of restitution, or you're going to want to go and argue that restitution is too complicated and that under the law, the court has the ability to not order restitution, for example. Or you want to go and argue about specific claims that were submitted and prove that, you know, they were medically necessary or whatever it is you want to do to try to attack it. You can kick the can on restitution. The law allows it for up to 90 days. And then the court can extend jurisdiction beyond 90 days if they so order. But there's sometimes value in accepting responsibility, full in the face, having the family and the kind of kumbaya in the courtroom at sentencing. And then later litigating over the money when not as many people are sort of paying attention, just in terms of the intensity in the courtroom, so to speak.
I totally agree with that. And one other thing I meant to mention too is keep in mind if there are multiple defendants that are involved in a particular case, I have also seen it happen that there is a loss amount that is just kind of agreed to in one of the cases. And then your case comes along and there's a realization that the same case, maybe there was an error in that loss calculation, or they, you know, people weren't focused on it, right? And that can happen, and it makes it awkward for the government, obviously, because they're on record as having said, this is the amount. And then, you know, as a practical matter, how you deal with that in your case, you know, is it leverage for you? Is it not leverage for you? Is it something, a lever you want to pull or not? Those are all questions you'll have to consider based on the facts of your case. But there are mistakes that are made. Even courts make the mistake. And then trying to undo that and unring that bell can be complicated.
And that can be particularly an issue, Eric. I think that's a great point. It can be particularly a problem when there's a corporate DPA that's got an admitted statement of facts that's followed then by individuals being sentenced when, you know, the company agreed to a number based on it being a number of convenience based on their own factors or their own decision-making process. And now you've got these individuals who are facing actual prison time coming up behind the company who are having to face down this statement of facts that says, you know, the loss amount was, you know, 10.8 million. When, you know, you want to argue that the loss amount was 35,000, not that I'm throwing around numbers from an actual case. you know, it's certainly true with individual defendants, but I think it can become even more complex when you've got a corporate resolution followed by individuals.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I apologize, I have to run to deal with a client emergency, but I'm going to let these fine folks continue the conversation. It was great to see you all.
Thank you so much, Eric. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
So I think then maybe to wrap up, I think one last question is good, will be helpful here. And I think if we could take one takeaway from this, it's that loss is really complicated. And one question I think all of us have is, what is the path forward here? Does banks tell us that we should be moving away from the comments and trying to simplify the calculations? Should we be trying to move for a more common sense application of the guidelines? Kate, maybe I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really tough question. And I, you know, as Dave noticed, it's certainly not a new question. But we've been having it at least since 2014, probably since before then. And tinkering with 2B1.1 seems to be a hobby. And, you know, it's good for, you know, folks like Dave and I, who are obsessed, to have hobbies like 28-page bench books. But it seems to me when you have to spend that much time explaining how a guideline works, that we maybe aren't, we're getting away from what a defendant could reasonably foresee, what a reasonable expectation is. And I think one of the things we didn't really talk about in a lot of detail, but is especially when you put it in the context of the fact that most individual defendants aren't actually getting sentenced to time that's commensurate with the loss table. I mean, there is a genuine tension in the loss table between making sure that companies don't benefit from misconduct, which is one of the reasons why the thresholds were raised, and you're not going to put somebody in jail for judges aren't sentencing at the guidelines, especially for high loss cases. And I don't know if maybe the way to do it is to split it in a corporate versus an individual case, that, you know, to throw out a piece of insanity. But it seems like we keep getting more complicated, and I worry that we need to back ourselves out before it's too late and maybe try another approach altogether. But Dave, do you have thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I think that's really insightful. And I would love to see a comprehensive review of sentencing in action, because as many of us have, I've practiced in multiple federal courts around the country, and there are courts where you're pretty much guaranteed to get a downward departure or a variance. And then there are courts where if the low end of the guideline is X, you can tell your client you're getting X. And so it just seems incredibly unfair when the swing can be, like I said earlier, you know, a quadruple what it might be somewhere else, based purely on what U.S. Attorney's Office is bringing the charges, or what component of main justice is bringing the charges. And so from a fairness perspective, whatever the outcome is, it would be really helpful if the Sentencing Commission would look at the data and, you know, decide how to deal with this, you know, I'd say once and for all, but that'll never be the case, but at least for the next 10 years.
Yeah. There's a real cognitive dissonance when Aggregate Industries gets fined $50 million and nobody and Prosperity doesn't go to jail. I mean, whichever one of those you think is right, it doesn't seem to me that both of them can be.
That's right.
It perhaps reflects attention that the sentencing guidelines give us really in every section. That the sentencing guidelines are trying to create a map that every district in the country can use so that the defendant in Ohio is treated the same way as the defendant in Massachusetts. But at the end of the day, we all know in practice that it's very different. So in trying to reconcile that tension of how do we have consistency across jurisdictions with how do we acknowledge the fact that that consistency is going to vary tremendously based on judge, it makes it really hard to get to a right answer of how do we create a guidelines that can acknowledge this. I want to thank everyone today. And is there anything that anyone would like to add about loss, restitution, forfeiture? Or is everyone just at a loss for words? Because I was going to make a pun before the end of this and I had to do it at some point.
Great. Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks to the Boston Bar.
Thank you.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.